It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are several items that can be difficult to find in the stores that do remain open, including hand sanitizer, paper products, and diapers. How are the lost jobs and income affecting parents trying to keep their little ones clean? Kathy Battle is the executive director of the Western Pennsylvania Diaper Bank. Welcome back to the Confluence, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. Kathy, your organization is the only diaper bank in the region. For those not familiar, you get diapers to families who struggle to afford them. Where do the diapers come from?
So a lot of the diapers come from the community. And then we also receive diapers from the National Diaper Bank Network through Huggies.
Typically, how many families are you helping during normal times?
We distributed over 500,000 diapers in 2019. Every month with our 28 social service agencies, we were distributing between 40 and 50,000 diapers a month.
And now, since the coronavirus outbreak, how many are you giving out? Has it increased?
It has definitely increased. My partner agencies have increased drastically because they're seeing more of a need. I've received calls from restaurant workers. They are definitely in need. Families saying that they're out of work, they need diapers. Diapers are very expensive. And even before the pandemic, there was no government assistance for diapers.
So you mentioned the increase. Do you have any numbers about how many you've been distributing during March or in the past week or something?
So I would say this past week, I've distributed 10,000 more diapers. And the supply that we have is being depleted by our social service agencies that we partner with before the pandemic. And we're trying to help the community at large, but we cannot do this by ourselves. We need the support of the community to help keep these babies dry.
With the social distancing directives, how are you safely getting those thousands and thousands of diapers to the parents?
So what we're having them do is pull up to our warehouse. They stay in their car and we load their van or their car or whatever they're driving. We load them up and then they pull off.
Is the affordability the main factor? What about availability of diapers on store shelves?
And that's another factor too. They're not available. And if you can buy diapers, a lot of them can only buy maybe a pack at a time, and then they cannot afford to buy the big box diaper, so they buy just a small pack, and then they go back, and then the small packs are not there, and then right now, some of them don't have transportation to get to the grocery store or the big box store.
Are other agencies, organizations looking for your help, maybe groups that didn't need the help before?
Yes, we're going out in Claritin, and we're going to distribute diapers with them as they give out their lunches to the families, because a lot of those families have stress need that they need help for diapers, too. I see that only increasing.
Kathy, are you concerned that whether it's because of affordability or accessibility, that babies' diapers might not get changed as frequently as they should, and that could lead to other health concerns?
That can lead to severe diaper rash. That could lead to urinary tract infection. You know, that's the baby's health. And I'm before this, mothers were leaving the babies in diapers long periods of time. They were, you know, rinsing the diapers out and trying to reuse them again. So I'm sure that it'll come back to that if we don't help.
Kathy, at this point, have you had to say no to anybody? And what happens if you do?
You know, sometimes I do have to say no, and I don't like to say no.
And can people still donate diapers directly to the diaper bank?
Absolutely. We can keep these babies dry. We can keep this going.
Kathy Battle is the executive director of the Western Pennsylvania Diaper Bank. Kathy, thanks so much for your good work.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. With non-essential businesses forced to close, a staggering number of people have found themselves without a steady source of income. With us now to talk about an innovative attempt at softening that financial blow to some is WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. Bill, thanks for taking the time.
Sure thing, Kevin.
A Carnegie Mellon University professor has organized what's being called a virtual tip jar. Bill, tell us how this all came about.
Well, Danielle Wenner is a philosophy professor at Carnegie Mellon University. And before, as the shutdown was approaching, about almost 3 weeks ago now, she became concerned about, you know, what was going to happen to folks who really rely on tips. As folks probably know, servers, bartenders get very little in the way of wages. They really rely on tips for most of their income. Danielle Wenner is a former server herself. She did some bartending and serving when she was in college and grad school. And she just came on this idea just the night before the shutdown was going to happen. She went online. She saw that something like it was happening in Washington, D.C. And she got some of her colleagues at the Center for Ethics and Policy at Carnegie Mellon University to set up this very simple kind of virtual tip jar.
And what kind of people have been using the site? Service industry workers, like waiters, cooks, others?
Mostly folks in the bar and restaurant industry, from what I can tell from the list. It's, waiters, bartenders. But you also do find, like I said, drivers on there. There's some stylists and things like that. Really anything, anybody who would get tipped. And they don't really police the site either. So anybody who feels that they might be able to benefit from this because of lost income, because of the shutdown, is allowed to go on there.
So how's the money exchanged? Did Professor Wenner of the Center for Policy and Ethics set up an infrastructure to exchange the money?
No, not at all. It's really just a way to put people who want to help in contact with people who need help. So the people who want to get tips supply their Venmo or PayPal contact information, and you pay them that way.
Does the Center for Policy and Ethics get a cut of this for setting it up?
Not at all. It's a completely philanthropic thing. They don't handle any money. They don't get any money. They don't even keep track of the amount of money that's spent. So they have no way of knowing how many folks this is benefiting or by how much.
Do they know who is using it? They're not keeping track of how much has been dropped into that virtual tip jar, you say?
Not at all, no. It's really just like a Google spreadsheet that's public. So people sign up on it. They have now, they've added a randomizer on there. So basically what happens is you go on the site and they give you a random person. There's over 6,000 names on the site right now. On the spreadsheet, and they give you one of those names because that one of their concerns was that people would go on and say, oh, I want to help, but there's too many names on here. I feel like it doesn't matter. That this randomizer just kind of pulls a name at random from among those 6,000 plus, and then you can tip them.
And that random name, does it also include their occupation or when they are employed, their occupation? Like, I wanted to help out this waitress. I wanted to help out this tattoo artist. Or is it just the name?
It's a name or the place where they work, I believe. The last time I looked at it, you can say, like, there's a particular restaurant that I want to help out the staff at, you know, presumably because you go there. And you can also choose that and it'll choose a random a server or other staffer at that location.
So how does the out-of-work server or creative professional sign up for the tip jar?
Yeah, you just provide your name, where you work, what you do there, you know, whether you've lost work or completely or had your hours cut back, and then you provide your Venmo or PayPal information. That's all it takes.
Has Professor Wenner said anything about, hey, this is working out the way I hoped it would?
Well, as I said, she doesn't know what's going on, nor does really anybody have a big picture idea. She has heard from a few people who said, oh, it's a great idea. She uses it herself. She and her partner, during the shutdown, she told me when they're at home, whenever they have a beer or have a drink, they go on the site and they tip somebody. So it's a nice way of, it's a nice way of reminding themselves to do it. I did speak with one local gentleman named Byron Nash. He's a well-known local bartender. He bartends at the Abbey and at Smallman Galley. He said he had received a few $100 from this. He had received tips as big as $50 in a single tip. So I've confirmed that there are people benefiting from it. I just don't know how many.
So will the site continue throughout this economic crisis, no matter how it lasts, how long it lasts?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, it really is not costing anyone anything for this to run. It basically runs itself, more or less. you know, with very little kind of maintenance. So they're as far as I know, they're just going to keep doing it, and hopefully it'll help some of these folks that are out of work and probably having a hard time getting unemployment benefits too, because the system is so swamped right now.
And as Bill said, if you're interested in tipping a server or other service worker, you can check out the link to the virtual tip jar on our website, WESA.FM. Bill O'Driscoll is the arts and culture reporter for WESA. Bill, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. With Pennsylvania schools closed indefinitely, districts are trying to move online quickly. The first hurdle is getting laptops to students who need them. But computers are of limited use without internet access. Keystone Crossroads reporter Avi Wolfman-Arendt talked to rural school superintendents who are hustling to get kids connected.
When rural superintendents describe their districts, they'll often begin by telling you the size.
We're 144 square miles.
Having 186 square miles.
About 86 square miles, very rural, very remote.
That last voice belongs to Matthew Splain. He runs the Otto Eldred School District, right along central PA's border with New York State.
We don't have a stoplight, so if that gives you an idea of how small and rural we are.
Size can be a point of pride for rural districts, but when it comes to internet connectivity, it can also be an obstacle.
In our area, you have a wide range from high-speed cable internet with 100 megabytes of service down to zilch. Because of the hills and the terrain.
Otto Eldred faces two problems here. About 6 in 10 families are low income, and some can't afford internet. But the district also has students who live in areas so remote they either have slow internet service or none at all.
The disparity in what there's available is just huge.
The FCC estimates about 600,000 Pennsylvanians don't have access to broadband internet. And those that do have internet don't necessarily have great connections. In McKean County, where Splain works, one study found that the average download speeds were well below what the federal government considers broadband speed. That leaves Splain scrambling for alternatives. Teachers are making sure assignments are available in paper form, and the district may turn school parking lots into Wi-Fi zones where families can drive up and download packets of work.
We're trying to set it up so that kids can have a option A and option B to complete the work.
Kathy Keegan of the Milton Area School District, south of Williamsport, thought her district would be in great shape. After all, they'd already given every child a laptop or tablet.
We thought, wow, this is great. We at least are ready with devices and a hybrid learning model and students being familiar with different online learning tools.
Then they hit the internet wall. 240 students and staff told the district they couldn't get online at home. The district decided to order Wi-Fi hotspot devices for all of them, but then learned that coronavirus had completely changed the market for this technology.
They've gone from zero cost with a one-year commitment to up to $200 a hotspot with varying years of commitment.
The district had to act fast to get their hands on whatever was left, spending about $15,000 in the process.
If we even blinked and a couple minutes went by, those hotspots were sold and gone.
Keegan says the district had no choice. It wanted to make sure everyone could get online by this past Monday when online classes started.
We're doing our very best to be present for our students and to follow a directive to continue education. We think it's important.
One southwestern PA district asked local businesses to host free Wi-Fi zones. You can now pull up to a campground or a Dairy Queen and download your assignments. Matthew Splain of the Otto Eldred School District says everyone is just trying to be creative and flexible.
I'm sure we'll have some snags. I think that's one thing we've understood is that we're going to have some difficulties. It's a matter of being ready to overcome them.
Moving a school district online takes a lot of trial and error, but you can't experiment until you get connected. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Keystone Crossroads.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We know that breathing in polluted air is bad for people's lungs. Scientists say that could make them more susceptible to getting sick from the coronavirus. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports air quality could play a big role in how the pandemic plays out.
A few years ago, Karen Clay and two other scientists did a study of death rates for the 1918 flu pandemic.
So we look at 183 cities. It's basically every city in the United States for which there is data.
Clay is an economist at Carnegie Mellon University. She was interested in whether more people died in cities with high air pollution from burning coal compared to those in cities with less air pollution.
Places with higher coal-fired capacity had more severe pandemics.
The group found mortality rates were about 10% higher in cities with the dirtiest air, accounting for an additional 30,000 to 42,000 deaths in the U.S. Other studies found similar effects for other outbreaks like SARS in 2003. So far, Allegheny County has had fewer cases of novel coronavirus than several counties near Philadelphia. But Clay worries air quality in cities like Pittsburgh, which fails to meet federal standards, could mean more people get COVID-19, and those who get the virus could be more likely to have a more severe case or even die.
I think that we would have a less severe outbreak if we had lower levels of air pollution.
There's plenty of evidence that pollution can make respiratory infections like COVID-19 worse. Sally Wenzel at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health says pollution can damage the cells that line breathing passageways. These cells form a natural defense for the lungs from foreign agents.
But when they're damaged, they don't function nearly as well as a barrier, and so things like viruses can get through that barrier and into the body, into the deeper spaces of the body.
This kicks off an inflammatory response in the lung that can then lead to further infection. Of course, there are a lot of other factors impacting the coronavirus pandemic. Social distancing and hand washing can slow the spread of the virus, and those who smoke or have underlying health issues like diabetes could be at greater risk of illness or death. But scientists are also studying whether the air in the industrial city of Wuhan, China, and Milan, Italy, which has some of the most polluted air in Europe, made the pandemic there worse. The air in those cities has cleared up, as governments have locked down economies to slow the spread of the virus. That's also happening in the U.S.
It just sort of flatlined.
Albert Presto studies air pollution at Carnegie Mellon University. He says pollution levels around the Pittsburgh area have fallen, especially during rush hour.
So we have a sensor downtown, you know, and typically, you know, it sees this big bump every morning from people going to work, and that has just pretty much disappeared the last couple of weeks.
Traffic is way down, and the largest industrial polluter, U.S. Steel, is scaling back production. Scientists don't know yet whether a few weeks of suddenly cleaner air will blunt the impact of the virus. Those answers will only come when the pandemic ends. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. A reminder to keep up to date on how the spread of the new coronavirus is affecting our region, go to our coronavirus blog that is updated throughout the day at WESA.FM. Today's show and past programs can be found at WESA.FM/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcast. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Helen Wigger, Kylie Kozinski, and Megan Harris. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Please be safe, and I hope you have a good day of good news.